During Robert Brogdon's Olathe Buick GMC clearance event, save up to 20% on new models like the 2023 Buick Encore GX or GMC Sierra 1500. View their huge inventory at robertbrogdon.com and find your perfect match.
The one and only Buster Olney joins us to talk Major League Baseball. Good morning, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing okay. A little tired. I was at Fenway Park last night for Sir Paul McCartney, a concert, and got back home to New York at about 2:30 in the morning. But, man, what a show. That was so much fun.
Buster Olney answering the bell early in the morning after a late-night concert trip to Fenway Park. Paul McCartney at Fenway Park. Man, I saw Paul McCartney at Arrowhead Stadium as a junior in high school. Oh, Namdi, we're discussing age here, Buster. This is bad because our intern Namdi pointed out to me that he had not been born yet when Outkast's song Fresh and Clean came out in 2000. He hadn't been born yet. I saw Paul McCartney in 1993 at Arrowhead Stadium. And I hate to say this, Buster, in my mind, he was old at that time. You know, that was my dad's music, and I love the Beatles, so it was awesome to see him, and he was great. He's still going, and he's still doing well.
So he did a show at Fenway on Tuesday night, and then because there was so much interest, this a few months ago, they saw the interest, they arranged for back-to-back nights, and I was kind of skeptical, like, what's his energy level going to be? How's his voice going to be? Knowing that he's going to go back-to-back, he killed it. It was crazy. It was so much fun. So I bet you the Angels, if I'm the Angels, and last night they played Nickelback for the walk-up music for all their hitters going up, you know what? They lost. They got a bag Nickelback. They should get Paul McCartney, Beatles, Wings, and all that.
Yeah. I don't know if I can't name a Nickelback song. I'm sure if you played one for me, I would recognize it. This is the thing I remember about watching Paul McCartney at that time was the smile that he had on his face when he played all of his old songs. And I remember watching him do an interview one time where he was kind of reliving some of his moments with the Beatles. And he just, in this interview, he got this smile where he said, "Man, we were good." And, I watched that documentary that they put out on Apple TV about the last recording sessions, and you could see all the angst of the band as they were getting ready to break up. And you could see the heartbreak in Paul McCartney's eyes that this is one of the greatest musical groups to ever live, and we're breaking up. I feel like you could see more than anybody else on stage that played with him how much he loved the music that he made.
Oh, I mean, and that came through last night. At one point during the show last night, he paused to look out the crowd and said, "We can always tell the difference between when we play our new stuff versus when we play, the Beatles or, some of our big hits with Wings, because," he said, "I look out on stage when we play the Beatles and everyone's got their phone up and it looks like we're the, cosmos of the universe." He said, "Then I play one of my new songs, and it's like you're staring it into an abyss," and everybody in the ballpark laughed. And he goes, "And you know what? We don't care. We're going to have fun." That's what just shone through last night, was how much fun he had. Imagine what a rush that would be to stare out. And I'm guessing the crowd was about 40,000 people last night, where you got the words that you wrote when you're, 20, 22, 23, sitting in a, over a cup of coffee one morning, and those words are being screamed back at you in bad voices by idiots like me. How much fun that would be to be able to do that for 50 years. What a 60 years. What a rush.
there's a transition to baseball here, though, Buster, because I experienced, and you experienced it for your professional career in a lot of ways, the life of traveling with the Major League Baseball team. I did it for parts of 4 years with the Royals, and it's very much like being on a concert tour every year. You're never sleeping in the same bed for more than two or three nights in a row. Even when you're home, you don't feel like you're at home because you got games every single night, every Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I know people listening, I've heard this from people before. Oh, shut your whining up. Everybody would love to travel the Major League Baseball team. I don't do it anymore, so I'm not whining about it. I'm thinking back to a point in my life when I did it, and I realized, honestly, after a few years of it, I don't think this is for me. I love being at ball games and all that, but this never being home thing and not remembering what hotel room I'm in and all that stuff, I just don't think it's what I want. And I remember being around baseball players and coaches who trudge through it. You know, they talk about the grind of being on the road, the grind of having a game every night, and there's almost this kind of put your head down and just get through it type mentality. And then there's other people like Paul McCartney, and because there's musicians. I mean, how many musicians have written songs about how hard life is on the road? Rocket Man.
I was going to mention
right?
that.
You know, I mean, every artist at some point writes a song about how hard life is on the road. And then there's like Paul McCartney, who just seems to enjoy every second of it. Like guys like Salvador Perez, that's one of the things I always found so refreshing about him. He seemed to, like he genuinely loved every second of it, or still does.
Thank you, my friend.
And that maybe that's part of the difference between guys that can play forever and be really successful and guys that kind of grind through their career and don't make as much out of it.
There's no doubt about it. And it's funny, you stole my line, because I was going to say, how many of those 70s and 80s bands, you know, did we hear, you know, who played those mournful songs about being on the road? Like they, you know, and how their lives broke apart because they did that. And as you were saying that, I'm like, I can't remember one of those songs from the Beatles or from Paul McCartney. You know, they didn't complain. They sort of relished, you know, what was in front of them. And you're 100% right. You know, Salvador Perez comes to mind. Mike Trout comes to mind. Like Mike Trout, when you're around him, he has a blast. It feels like every day for him is like what the way it was. Well, maybe not these days when the Angels don't win any games. But you know, every day he seems to really draw so much joy coming out to the ballpark. I didn't cover George Brett. He absolutely strikes me as being one of those like, hey man, I get to play baseball today. How cool is that? Which is why, as you know, his words about, you know, what do you want your 3,000 hit to be? He wanted to talk about beating out an infield grounder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're 100% right. That's the separator.
Well, and that's what surprised me about what's happened with Joe Maddon in with the Angels, because I've only had brief windows into what it was like to be around Joe Maddon, but I remember when he used to come to Kansas City when he was with the Rays, and I was covering the Royals clubhouse on a daily basis at that time. Like, you don't always go over to the other team, to the visiting team, to listen to the coach talk. We always went over there to get sound bites from Joe Maddon because he was engaging with the media. He seemed to enjoy his interactions with the media. And you always seemed like you picked up something from him. You heard a phrase or learned something that you hadn't heard before. And he seemed like one of the – I've read the stories about the different things he would do with the team to try to keep things fresh and interesting and fun when they're going on the road and out of town. So what went wrong in Anaheim with him?
Yeah, and it was interesting because a lot of folks, I think, were surprised by that change. I was not. You know, their owner, Artie Moreno, was known for volcanic temper, for, you know, being impetuous, for making decisions. For example – you know, in 48 hours, he rushed in and gave Albert Pujols $240 million. You know, Mike Socha used to be, you know, the most powerful person in that organization. And then when they started losing, he basically got put in the doghouse. So that's, you know, if you're in the Angels organization, that's part of the dynamic there. But they're also, among the front office folks, there was a lot of frustration with some of Joe's decisions. And I'll give you an example. You know, during the wintertime, during the labor shutdown, the Angels had internal conversations about moving Mike Trout to the corner outfield, to a corner outfield spot, right field or left field, to save wear and tear on him, and they have a terrific young outfielder named Brandon Marsh that they were going to put in center field. Spring training began, and Joe Maddon told reporters that, you know, they were talking about doing this. Here was the problem. He hadn't talked to Mike Trout yet. Trout, you know, told reporters later that day, yeah, I just saw that on social media. That made the Angels front office folks pull their hair out. We had that decision earlier this year when Joe walked Corey Seager of the Rangers with the bases loaded to intentionally force in a run in like the fourth inning of a game. And Joe, you know, tried to explain his perspective on it afterward. there were folks in the Angels front office and folks around the game were like, that makes no sense whatsoever. And there were a number of those type of decisions. And so I think, you know, as long as they were winning, they were going to be okay with it. But then they started to lose. Perry Manassian, who didn't hire Joe, I think said, you know what, if we're going to lose and the ship is going to go down, I'm going to go down with somebody I'm more comfortable with.
So I want to go back to what you said about Artie Moreno, because we're still learning about Mr. Sherman, the new principal owner of the Kansas City Royals. They've got a big ownership group now here in town, but we don't really, you know, he's everything I hear about him is wonderful. Everybody loves him here in town, but we haven't really seen any major baseball moves yet from him. The biggest thing we've seen around here is there's plans to try to move the baseball stadium downtown, which I think most people in Kansas City think would be a great thing. I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think overwhelmingly that's the thought process. But when it comes to the baseball operations, there hasn't been much yet. He's facilitated Dayton Moore and J.J. Piccolo to go do the job the way that they've done it before. He hasn't been one of these guys to come in and just shake things up because he's already got his notions on how things should be. But obviously, this season's off to an absolutely terrible, rotten start. There's no other way to put it. And what I hear from Royals fans, yesterday, Buster, when I went to take my car to the Highway Patrol to get inspected for its new license, the guy that was inspecting it, first thing he said to me, "How's Mike Matheny still have his job?"
Yeah.
And I, the Royals are obviously, Dayton Moore is not as prone to making emotional decisions about guys that he's hired the way that it sounds like Artie Moreno is. How do you characterize, like, when teams make decisions on managers like this? Because we've seen two go already. I guess, like, just because the Angels did it doesn't mean that their timing is right, because you just described to me a man. I don't want to have an owner who's making rash decisions left and right. That was a terrible decision to sign Pujols to a contract. So I don't know. I guess what my question is, what should the timing be like when it comes to a season like the Royals are having right now?
The most important factor in that, as you sort of determine what each, you know, team is going to do, is money, right? The Phillies spent a lot of money this year to try to win. You know, they signed Nicholas Castellanos, they signed Kyle Schwarber, they already had Bryce Harper, and they got off to a terrible start. And Joe Girardi said after he got fired the other day, hey, there are high expectations, and we didn't get it done. And so someone loses their job. The exact same thing is in place with the Angels. They got Mike Trout. They got Anthony Rendon. They got Shohei Ohtani. High expectations, which were ratcheted up by the fact they got off to a good start. So when they start to lose, someone loses their job. I don't think that the expectations for the Royals were nearly that high, and they certainly didn't spend a ton of money. But I do think this is going to be a litmus test for Mr. Sherman and how he's going to run the team. You know, how aggressive is he going to be? Will he step in? I don't know him. I've heard around the edges that he's not a reactionary type owner. But I will tell you, with the time I've covered baseball, and I'm sure it's been this way for you too, you hear about scouting reports on various owners, and that can change over time. Like at some point, someone, because these guys all have had success in their previous lives before they got into baseball. The best example that in 1972, a man bought a big market team, and the initial story was he's expected to be an absentee owner. That was George Steinbrenner. Okay? That was the initial story in the New York Times. He's expected to be an absentee owner, and instead he jumped in and, of course, became probably the most aggressive owner we've ever seen, spending money, firing managers, get involved. And I'm not suggesting that Mr. Sherman's going to be that way, but something worth watching.
So the expectations, I think it's an interesting question, because you're right. I don't think anybody, even in Kansas City, had the expectations of the Royals that maybe were on the Angels or the Phillies. The money hasn't been spent around here. But we've all talked about the fact that our expectations for this team was to take a step forward this year from what they did last year, and maybe challenge 500. That I didn't pick them to go 500, but I thought that wouldn't be an unreasonable, you know, hope, and that they should get close to 500 this year, and we should see signs of progress. And while these other two teams that lost their managers or let go of their managers are underperforming their expectations, the Royals are underperforming their expectations based on the fact that they've got the worst record in baseball and the worst run differential in baseball, and those young pitchers, you can pick out little signs of hope, you know, but overall, they've almost all taken a step back this year. And I guess that brings up the question then, were our expectations wrong? Is this team not as good as we thought it was? Or is somebody failing when it comes to why this team's performing the way that it is?
Yeah, and I think in order to give you a detailed opinion on that, I would need to be covering the team on a daily basis, and I'm not. But I will tell you this, that whatever happens in this moment, when you have the worst record in baseball and you have the worst run differential, whatever decision would be made, either by JJ or Dayton or ownership, that's been earned, right? You couldn't complain. If you were someone, if they jumped in and said, okay, this person's being moved here, this person's being let go, we're trading this person, we're doing this move, at this point, it's absolutely earned because they've been terrible. There's no way around that. And everything you laid out for how they performed is exactly right. And again, context is everything, and I think you phrased it perfectly. No one expected them to, came into the year saying the Royals are going to win the World Series, but there was an expectation that they were going to get better, and they haven't. I think the next thing to look for is as they begin to, look at promoting some of their, best guys in the minor leagues, do you see improvement after that? Or have you seen enough if you're, in the front office, your ownership, where you're like, I want to see a different answer. And we also get to a point where a team is buried so deep in the standing that the focus starts to be a little bit on 2023, where you begin to ask the question, do we think this guy's going to be on the team for next year? Do we think we can put ourselves in a better position for 23? This is where, a guy like Andrew Benintendi, and I was talking with a high-ranking executive with another team the other day, he said, yep, our expectation is he's going to be put out on the market at some point. And given where they are, sooner rather than later.
I want to bring in Marco Marquez. He's got a question for you here, Buster.
Yeah, Buster, I'm just curious. We saw now with Madden and Girardi fired, who's the next, who's got the hottest seat in baseball when it comes to managers? Who could we see next get relieved of their duties?
Wow.
What a morbid question from Marco, by the way, Buster, for you right there.
And I'm looking at it. That's one of those ones where, having a moment of thought here, and I don't think he's going to be fired in midseason, but Dave Martinez of the Nationals, they're 21-37. They're having a terrible year, and he's in the last year of his contract. That one is certainly, I think, one to watch. I think David Bell, everyone knew the Reds were going to be bad this year. He's okay. Derek Shelton of the Pirates have been better than expected. He's okay. David Ross of the Cubs, he's going to be okay. I don't know if there's someone on a seat quite as hot. Now, I mentioned, I have no indication the Royals are necessarily going to change anything, but I think whatever they do going forward, I think everyone's going to be like, well, we gave it a shot.
So this is interesting, Buster, because one of the things, when we text back and forth about topics to discuss, you brought up the Cardinals and what a good team they are. And to me, I make this comment often when we talk about manager hot seats and all of that, that I believe that the manager in baseball is maybe the most overrated when it comes to the influence they have on wins and losses in the major sports I know when it comes to coaching. I think in NFL, it's like the coach is the thing. The coach is more important than the GM or anybody else. In baseball, I feel like, there's a limited amount that a manager can actually affect in a game. And I look at Mike Matheny. He won a lot of games in St. Louis. He's not 100%. In St. Louis anymore. He's losing a lot of games. And the Cardinals just keep on winning. And is that because Mike Matheny got, you know, became a bad manager here and doesn't know what he's doing? Or maybe the organization in St. Louis is a really well-run machine? I mean, you know, how do the Cardinals keep winning year after year?
So as part of my answer to you, in 2015, that was the first year that Joe Maddon was with the Cubs. And he was doing all those things you mentioned, like he's serving breakfast to the players on the field during batting practice, having a buffet table behind the batting cage. He, you know, bringing zoo animals. He's doing all that stuff. And at the end of that year, and the Cubs, and I can't remember the number of wins they improved. It was like 30 wins. At the end of the year, there was a staff meeting among the Cubs executives, and they went around the table and said, how many wins do you think Joe made in terms of a difference? And this is a very analytically driven front office, and the estimates were from 6 to 15 wins. So there was a belief that Joe Maddon made a tremendous difference with that young group of players with the Cubs. And so it's not impossible that the manager can make a big decision. I personally think that what's gone on with the Cardinals, and Ollie Marmol has been an excellent fit. He reminds me, we had him on Sunday Night Baseball last weekend, he reminds me of a combination of Alex Cora and Kevin Cash of the Rays in terms of how he's, you know, relates to players and his sense of humor and his competitiveness during the course of games. I think that what we're seeing with the Cardinals is a merging of, you know, these excellent veteran players like Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado with the fact that they've done a tremendous job with their player development system. That's what is really striking when you watch the Cardinals these days, is that, yeah, they've got those older star players that they've acquired from other teams, but Nolan Gorman looks like he's a player. He looks like he's going to hit like crazy. Brendan Donovan, playing a right field, he is a gamer, 22 years old. And you look at that group and you feel like, you know, as this season goes along, they could get better as those young players get more comfortable. The big X factor for the Cardinals, for me, is Jack Flaherty. You know, he's coming back from injury. Is he going to be the guy that we saw in 2019, a front end of this, the rotation type guy, or is he going to be more middling as he, you know, continues to have more injuries? But last weekend was the first time when I saw the Cardinals in a while, and I thought, you know what, that team could win the World Series if they go on a run in the postseason.
Buster, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it, and I hope maybe you get a little bit of rest after you do this interview with us from the Paul McCartney concert, and we will talk to you next week.
All right, I think my voice is going to go, but you know what? If Paul McCartney can make it work, I should.
What was your favorite song? Like, what was the song that got you most excited that you heard that you were singing in your poor Buster only voice loudest last night?
He did a medley from the Abbey Road album, and he announced beforehand, he said, we've never done this in a live concert before, and it was awesome. And it's one of my favorite favorite medleys that I've in music, and to listen to it and to hear him play it was just extraordinary. You know, I mean, you love Hey Jude, you love Let It Be, but to hear that medley done live was pretty cool.
Abbey Road's my favorite album by the Beatles, and that B-side is just one long medley. Is that what he did? He played the whole B-side?
Yep.
Oh, man.
Yep, basically. It was awesome.
She came in through the bathroom window.
There you go.
Oh, man, what a great – that's awesome. I would love to have seen that. Hey, Buster, thank you so much for the time, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, guys. Take care.
All right, that is Buster only. Always fun to talk with Buster. I think it's interesting – the way our attention shifts through the course of a baseball season. Because if you go back to mid-May, when Terry Bradshaw was let go, all of the attention at that time to me was on Cal Eldred. And nothing's really happened since then to indicate that things have gone better from a pitching standpoint for Cal Eldred since then. Yet now, when I talk to people, like yesterday when I was at the Highway Patrol, the talk is about Matheny. And it's almost like if you keep losing, then the pressure just keeps getting higher, right? Like, it starts at the position coach level. Then, if you keep losing, it goes up to the manager. Then, if you keep losing, it goes up to the front office. Then, if you keep losing, people start getting mad at the owner. Nobody can fire the owner, so that it kind of stops there at the GM thing. And I just think it's kind of interesting. Nothing ever happened with Cal Eldred, and I still hear people bringing him up sometimes, but it's almost like what I hear from people talking, everybody I talk to now in terms of fans, is it's almost like, well, if not getting anything with the pitching coach, are they going to do anything with the manager? And again, I'm not sitting here campaigning for it. First of all, calling for somebody's job is just not something that sits well with me. I mean, people were calling for Ned Yost's job. I thought his managerial run was finished when he brought in Yordano Ventura in that wild card game and he gave up the home runs. You know, a few weeks later, he's in the World Series. And a year later, he's a World Series champion. So I'm not sitting here. I mean, I've seen it before where they called Ned Yost a dunce, like the chess master versus the dunce, I think was the headline with Buck Showalter. And the Orioles were facing the Royals, and Ned Yost put a clown suit on Buck Showalter in that series. So I'm not calling for anything. I'm just describing what I hear from people when I talk to fans, when I'm having conversations with people about it, the tenor of the conversation. And I don't know, like I said, also, I don't want an owner that makes rash decisions. I mean, yes, do we want an owner that cares? Yes, of course. I don't want an owner that's over-involved like Jerry Jones. I don't want an owner that's going to go throw money away on an aging Albert Pujols the way Artie Moreno did. I mean, I think you look at the success that the Angels have not had, considering they've got maybe the two best baseball players on the planet playing for their team, and the amount of money that they've spent. And I don't look at that and go, well, we should be just like them. So, you know, I understand, like, I don't have a problem with patience. But the line of where patience and stubbornness crossover is a hard one to find. And I don't know the answer to that necessarily. I do think the Royals are at a place now. We're over 2 months into the season, and this season has been disastrous so far. That's not shock jock. That's not overstating things. It's just objectively what it is. It's been a disaster so far. And I think that if you're the Royals, you have to look really long and hard, because we talked about expectations with Buster. Nobody was calling for this team to make the playoffs. Nobody was saying, boy, if this team doesn't make the postseason, everybody should be fired. People just wanted to see progress. And right now, it's very difficult to find much of any. So to me, if you're in that situation, you have to look at it and say, okay, did we misevaluate what we have? Did we bring in the wrong players? Are these guys not as good as we thought they were? Do we have a player development issue? I asked J.J. Piccolo about that back in mid-May when those articles were coming about the pitching and how some guys like Jake Junis have gone elsewhere and had more success. And he said our processes are fine. They feel very good about their processes. Okay, so what's going wrong? And I think, you know, I hope they're taking a deep dive into that. And I hope they're not just coming up with the idea that, well, the pandemic screwed up all the development and we rushed these guys a little bit. Because we're seeing too many other young pitchers come up and be good. And their organizations went through the pandemic as well, right? And so I just think if you want to keep going forward, you've got to figure out what's going wrong. In life, if you make a big mistake, Lord knows I've made a million, the ones that I have a better chance of improving from are the ones that I can acknowledge, okay, this is what I got wrong. This is why I was wrong. This is how I'm going to fix it. But if you make a big mistake and you go, no, I didn't do anything wrong, the results were just bad. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I'm good. I'm going forward. I'm less optimistic about my opportunities to actually improve and to change the direction of things. And so that's, and I think from the outside looking in, it doesn't feel like, I mean, so they made the change at hitting coach. And the team's lost even more since then. That's the one change so far that we've seen, at least on the surface level. Maybe there are things happening behind the scenes that we don't know about, but from what we can see, it doesn't look like there's been a determination that anything needs to change at all. It's going to be interesting to see where that goes from here. We'll take a break. Back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Sporting Kansas City will be back in action on Sunday at 2 o'clock at Children's Mercy Park, and it'll be network television on ABC as Sporting take on the New England Revolution. And, of course, you can hear the game live right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB as well. And to talk about Sporting KC is the man in charge, Sporting Kansas City manager and technical director, Peter Vermees, joins us on the show. Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm good, Nate. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing fine, and I'm looking forward to getting back out to Children's Mercy Park on Sunday. This past weekend, I got to do something that I don't really get to do very often anymore, and that was sit in the stands at Children's Mercy Park as a fan. I went with my family out to the U.S. Men's National Team game. We sat in the south stand. By the way, it reminded me that there's not a bad seat in that stadium because we bought some of the cheapest tickets and we had great seats. I'm curious, did you watch the national team game closely here when they played Uruguay?
I did watch it, yes. I try to watch unless for some reason we have some event ourselves going on, but if the U.S. national team's playing, I'm always watching those games.
What did you think?
Obviously it's a great opportunity for Greg to continue to try a bunch of different players as he's going to, what he's doing now is he's trying to figure out what his roster is going to be. And it's not an easy task because, you got to figure out where you're going to have your ones, your twos, your threes, in certain positions and where you can get a player that can play multiple positions so that you can cover yourself. And I think that's really what he's trying to figure out. And then also if there's maybe a lot of coaches that put a World Cup team together, a lot of times what they do is they look for a player that nobody ever expects that you would pick, and they have their reasons. Sometimes it's they just believe that the player has something that can help them or that this player could be a player that might be used for the next cycle, and it'll be great to get him the experience of being at the World Cup. So there's a lot of different things that'll happen. I think you'll know who the regulars will be, but I think there'll be always one or two surprises.
So in 1990, you were a part of a United States men's national team that was trying to qualify for the World Cup right before the World Cup was going to be coming to the United States in 1994. And when you host it, you're the automatic qualifier. So you guys were going out there to send a message that, hey, the United States can qualify for a World Cup on their own merits. They don't need an automatic bid. And this team, the young group of guys, they qualified for this World Cup right before the World Cup's coming to the United States here in 4 years from now. I'm curious, as you look at this group compared to what you guys had, I know there's a lot of different circumstances. Do you see some similarities or maybe what do you think are some of the biggest differences between this situation and the one you went through in 1990?
I think things are completely different. Obviously the the scenario is the same, as you just stated, right? But we had qualified, you know, prior to this for, you know, I don't know how many cycles in a row since 1990, but, you know, prior to us, it was 40 years prior to that we qualified for a World Cup. So in that's where the difference is, but also the really big difference is that we didn't really have a professional league that was in place and able to hone the skills of the American players and have them be in great form to then participate in a World Cup at a high level. I think, and look, we went there to, you know, look, we went as players, we had the idea that, hey, of course, in your mind, hey, you want to win, you know, you believe you can win. But at the end of the day, there was no way we were going to win the World Cup, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where these guys, I think, have a really good chance of competing and get really far into the tournament. That's where the difference is that we just have so many better players. We have so many players that are playing, you know, internationally now. And the players that play internationally, it helps immensely because of two things. One is obviously they're playing in competitions that they have to be in top form for an entire year, and they're constantly being challenged at an incredibly high level with not only the level of competition but also the number of games that they're playing. It's the same thing in MLS, right? So the international aspect is good because they're bringing something back and they're playing amongst all those other players. And when they play them in the World Cup games, they're not intimidated. They just say, look, I play against these guys all the time. What's the big difference now? So that mentality, that attitude is great to have within the team. At the same time, we have a tremendous amount of players that are playing in MLS that are consistent impact players within their team, and they're playing on a regular basis as well. And so you have that scenario that you really didn't have back in my day.
I'm curious because even some of those players that are playing international developed in the United States in MLS academy systems, and some of them even professionally in MLS before they moved overseas. How far has MLS come when it comes to developing players for this, and how much credit do you guys as a league deserve, in your opinion, for some of this young talent we're seeing right now?
Well, I think right now what is happening is that, and it's changing very quickly from what I'm going to say, I think that, you know, the top leagues around the world have recognized that the United States is a place that you can go mine talent right now, and you better do it because what has happened is they've been able to get a lot of, you know, garage sale prices on players over the last so many years. But that's changing, and it's changing right now, right in front of our eyes, because those prices are not garage sale anymore. You know, they're obviously much more expensive, and that will continue. And to give you an analogy, you said something that's really interesting, right? We're developing players through our academies, and eventually they're, you know, being sold and going overseas. Well, let's take Daniel Shalloway. Daniel Shalloway never played professional soccer anywhere else except in the United States. I mean, he went on loan 1 year, but I'm saying he signed in the United States to become a professional. His professional soccer is here. He came over, you know, at a young age and played in our academy for a year, and then kind of worked up his way through the system. That's the other thing that is occurring as well. So when you talk about development of players, it's happening with all different pathways. And again, those players are incredibly attractive to foreign clubs and very, very high level leagues because our players are durable. They are they're physical, which if you look around the world, you know, every league now is the capacity from a physical perspective has to be top class. And if you can't withstand the physicality of the game, you're not going to find success in a player, and that player is not going to find success in his team.
That all transitions to this matchup on Sunday that you have against the New England Revolution, because your team last year, I feel like these two teams, you can make an easy argument, were maybe the two best teams in Major League Soccer last year. I know they didn't end up making it to the MLS Cup final, but through the balance of the season, New England won the points race. You guys were a handball away from finishing first place in the Western Conference. And this year, it's been hard for both teams to come back. Now, you sold Gianluca Busio overseas last year. They sold two guys last year in Buchanan and their goalkeeper Turner. And now Adam Buxa, they just sold for a reported $10 million as well. And I think one thing I do want to point out in this league is people are starting to call it a selling league, but I think it's a transactional league because you buy players as well. You guys bought Alan Pulido for a lot of money. How difficult is that part going to be to manage? You get good young players, you sell them, but then you got to have somebody lined up to bring in and timing it out and all those things. I'm curious, that part of this evolution of the league, how challenging is that going to be?
Well, I just think it's just taking on a different look, and you just you kind of adapt and adjust with that. I think you make a good point. It's not a selling league. It truly is. We're in the business of international soccer, international club soccer, and that business is that, you know, Busio is a great example. We signed him out of our academy. He's on I think he was on, don't hold me to this, but I think he was on like a 5-year deal. So we signed him to that deal knowing full well that prior to all of this, when he first came into the club, that he had this ambition of playing in Europe one day. And like I've said this story before, but I'll do it again, and it's really quick. And that is, before we signed him, I sat with his parents and him and asked him, what is your ambition? And every player always says the same thing. They always say, oh, I want to make the first team of Sporting and I want to play all the time. Yeah, I understand that. Of course I get that. And they want to be respectful, and I appreciate that. But what's your long-term ambition? Well, I want to play in Europe and, you know, possibly in Italy because he has heritage. His father's from Italy. I get it. I understand. The point is that's part of the human being that you're dealing with. And so when he said that, now it's up to understand that, okay, that's the situation. Let's prepare for that. And what was not going to happen is that it's not like we were out going, hey, we want to sell Busio. That was not the case at all. It was part of the plan with Busio. And so you could fight the plan, you could not sign him at all, or you could embrace the plan and then you take advantage of the situation when it arises for both parties, and you make sure that the details of the deal fit everybody. It's not just the financial part, it's everything. And so it's something that he wanted to do. We tried to offer him a new deal to sign for longer term, but he didn't want to because that's what he wanted to do, and this opportunity was in front of him. And so at that moment, you make that decision, you do that, but then what you do is you have to have, as you said, and that's where you're absolutely right, is that now you have to be in a position where you have players in waiting, or at least players that you've already scouted, and you already have a really good indication of what their propensity is to play in Major League Soccer, more importantly, maybe in Sporting Kansas City. You know exactly what their contracts are. You know what it may cost to get them out of their contract, or maybe they can come on a free, or maybe they can come on a loan. I mean, there's all these things that you're constantly evaluating amongst and against your current roster. And if you're doing that, you know, it works out well. What sometimes, unfortunately, what does happen, though, in this business as well, is that sometimes a player doesn't want to play in Kansas City, or his wife doesn't want to come to Kansas City, or he's got a better deal somewhere else, or what have you, because we're not just dealing against other MLS teams. We're dealing on the international market, and there's a lot of choices and options for players worldwide.
All right, Peter, to wrap things up here, let's look at this matchup you have against New England on Sunday. You guys had a bye week this past weekend. Your team had played a lot of games, 7 games in 22 days on a thin roster because you had a lot of guys banged up as well. How important was this past week? How healthy are you coming into this game? And obviously an important push into the summertime now.
We're not healthy. We're still not there yet like we need to be. The 2 weeks has been good. It's been good from the first week of giving the guys sort of a mental and physical break. This past week is good because it's the first time, as you said, in basically in a month that we're getting a chance to actually have a what I would call a normal build-up to a game, which is a 4 or 5 day build-up to a game, which we haven't had at all. Everything we were doing, as you stated, in that stretch of a really congested schedule was basically play, recover, play, recover, play, recover. And so now having the chance to train a little bit has been very healthy for us. And we're still trying to get players on the mend. They're still not there, quite a few of them. But, you know, that part of it is going to happen day-to-day progress, but we got to make the most of what we have available to us for each game. And so, you know, we start with New England this weekend, and we'll do everything we can to, you know, get a result because we need to.
2 o'clock on Sunday on ABC and right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Peter, thank you so much for the time, as always. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Nate. Good talking to you, buddy.
All right, that is Peter Vermes, and again, Network Television, Sporting Kansas City and New England, two of the most legendary coaches in American soccer history, going toe-to-toe with Peter Vermes and Bruce Arena. The most legendary meteorologist in Kansas City history, Gary Lezak, will join us next with a forecast. Oh, Mr. Blue Sky's out today. Gary Lezak, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, one of the many things I love about you, Gary?
What?
I love that good morning. You know, it's like you just, do you wake up on the right side of the bed almost every day?
Every single day.
It's amazing.
Every single day. You know what? Honestly, I rarely ever talk about this, but, you know, I was the morning meteorologist for 15 years of my career. I started in Oklahoma City. I got this job because somebody said the F word on the air, and I was able to get that first job in 1986 on the day of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. That's how I got my first job, by the way. Somebody literally said that bad word on the air, and I got that job. And all of a sudden, I was the morning meteorologist. And 15 years of getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning later, I began the chief meteorologist. So I got to sleep in a little bit, although I'm on with you guys every day, so I don't get to sleep in. Anyway.
Hey.
But I'm up at 6 or 7 anyway. But to answer your question, I started saying my first month on the air, good morning. And I was struggling because I wasn't getting much sleep those first few months, the first year or two. I would panic and scream. I'd call my mom and say, I can't. I'm not getting any sleep. I'm so tired. So I finally learned about this word, you know, bumptious. You get up with a bumptious feeling. It's like, boom, just bounce out of bed. Don't sit there and doze. Just jump up. So I jumped up every day of my career from that point on. And I was in a good mood. I didn't even have coffee, not even one coffee for those first 15 years. I didn't drink coffee. I just got up. I was excited. The weather data was in, and I got to work. And when the show started, it was good morning. That's how I started my day, and I felt like it helped people get started. That's
fantastic. I love the whole thing. I love your direction. I love how you're always in a good mood when you come on with us.
Am I always in a good mood?
I feel like most of the time. Yeah. Unless you're fighting with the star quarterback's wife on Twitter. you know.
Oh, boy.
Somebody brought that up to me the other day. I don't even remember why, but somebody's like, oh, man, I love the Lezak segment. I love when he gets in arguments with Alex Smith's wife on Twitter. So, well, he's passionate. You know, he loves his Chiefs.
I do. You know. I do. I love the Chiefs and love sports. I can't believe I get to be on sports radio with you guys, talk about weather and sports. And the running joke, I don't even do the weather. That's crazy.
Well,
you know, weather's my true passion.
Are we getting summer weather now? Like you said, summer starts pretty soon, right?
Yeah, I'm blogging about it right now on KSHB.com. It's pretty interesting. There's this block that formed over northern Canada. I just looked at the data from June 6th, the day before we had the tornadoes 2 nights ago, and the block got really strong up there. It's now breaking down. As long as it's up there, it'll prevent temperatures from heating up. That's why we've had a great spring since those four hot days in May a month ago. But now that's breaking down, so the heat's going to start building in, and so we're about to have some hotter weather next week. But today's going to be a spectacular day, and then there's a possibility of thunderstorms tonight. I know a lot of people are wondering if there's going to be severe weather like 2 nights ago. Remember, in my whole 30 years in Kansas City, a night like last night where there's a tornado in Johnson County down 95th Street and a tornado in Jackson County up near Buckner and other tree damage and wind damage around the area. Apparently there were two EF0 tornadoes in Miami County as well, so four tornadoes in our area. That is extremely rare. I mean, all 30 years, I mean, with those locations, it just never happened. So the chance of that happening is probably once in 30 years, just so you know, probably. But, you know, the LRC, just remember, we're in the same pattern this year, so we'll have to watch it. But tonight's risk is just not there. Expect there may be a few thunderstorms. The chance of severe weather is quite low, but we'll watch it closely. Today's high, about 82 degrees. Tomorrow, a little bit cooler, 79, 80 degrees. It'll dry out. I'm going to be out at the Symphony in the Flint Hills. I'm in the Field Journal talking about weather, and I'm going to be out there talking about the LRC, Weather 2020, my history of forecasting, and then if anybody has questions, it'd be great. I'm out there at 2 o'clock and 5 o'clock on Saturday, and the weather looks great. Nate, I've got three dad jokes.
Oh,
I can't believe it.
I got my pen ready to go here. All right, let's go. I'll be the judge of that.
Let's see if I can get one for three, that'd be better than every single Kansas City Royal. You know, wow. 333.
Wow.
You know, so.
Cheap shot.
Yes. Okay, so here we go. If there is a king size mattress and a queen size mattress, where does the prince sleep?
Where does the prince sleep?
The air mattress.
I like that. I like that. All right. I get that. Air,
oh,
H-E-I-R.
Oh, my God. I'm going to go for the cycle. There's
oh, man. Okay. You're already one for one. For me, anyway.
Okay. I had to fire the guy I hired to mow my lawn. He just didn't cut it.
Sounds like my son, my sixth grade son. Actually, I take, you know what? He mowed the lawn earlier this week, and I didn't even have to ask him to. Because there's a new video. And then I was like, why? And, well, there's a new video game that gets released tomorrow, and he's trying to raise as much money as possible. So, but I like that. I like the motivation there. So, okay. All right. That was that. That one was okay. I think that was a.
That was line drive foul.
Okay, I was going to say maybe like a sacrifice fly, no at bat.
Here comes the pitch. Here comes the pitch. Right? My friend Jack says he can communicate with vegetables.
Okay.
Jack and the beans talk. Jack and the beans talk.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I'll take it. I'll give it to you.
And it's a blooper. It's a blooper.
Yeah, that was a duck snort. That was a duck snort for a base hit. You know, but that's a line drive in the box score. So
that
I like
it. Been like a little number along third base, and it is fair. It's a base hit. There you go. Little number. I love little numbers. All right. I gave you three little numbers today. Have a good day, everyone. Hey, everyone should be part of this. This is a great, great addition to your health insurance. Pro Partners Healthcare. Here's Dr. Troy Burns.
Thanks, Gary. You know, most people are frustrated that they can never reach their doctor when they really need them. That never happens at Pro Partners. If you need easy, direct access to a doctor who knows you and is always available, give Pro Partners a call or check us out on the web at ProPartnersHealthcare.com.
Jack talking to vegetables reminds me of the song by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Call Any Vegetable, and the chances are good that the vegetable will respond to you. Back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.